Today, we are taking our conversation beyond Hawaii into the global landscape of drowning prevention. Drowning is often misunderstood. It's not just an accident, it's a public health issue that disproportionately affects those with the least access to resources, education, and safe environments. Our guest today brings a critical voice to that conversation. Dr. Colleen Saunders is an epidemiologist, a researcher based at the University of Cape Town, and a leader in drowning prevention through Life Saving South Africa. Today, we will be discussing a powerful concept: leave no one behind. What does that mean in the context of drowning prevention? Who are we missing? And how do we translate global research into real-world impact in places like Hawaii? Dr. Saunders, welcome to Deep Dive into Water Safety. I'm so glad
Thank you.
you join us.
I'm so excited to be here. This is wonderful.
Good. So, in your paper, Leave No One Behind, which I have here, an African perspective on the first World Health Organization Global Status Report on Drowning Prevention.
Yes.
You describe drowning as a neglected public health crisis. Why has drowning remained invisible compared to other global health issues, in your opinion?
I think I think there's a few reasons, and you touched on it a little just now in your intro as well. I think historically drowning's been viewed very much as a kind of a series of accidents, right? Of individual accidents, and not holistically as a kind of consolidated issue, a public health preventable issue. And so people tend to look at the individual accidents and or what are considered accidents and pick out the things from that particular story, but miss the point that there's a whole lot of factors that contribute to these things in a system, and they are actually preventable. I think the other main issue historically is that drowning's really been undercounted. So we haven't realized how big an issue it is because there's been undercounting with non-fatal drowning. We still don't really have a handle on the burden of non-fatal drowning. There's still a lot of underreporting of drowning deaths in certain areas, particularly in rural settings. And we, even in the current conversation, we haven't really started to bring in the issue of flood-related and transport-related drownings. Those are kind of counted as something else in the bigger picture. So I still think there is this under-recognition of the burden, although we now recognize that there's an under recognition, if that makes sense. But and that is starting to help us understand how big of an issue it is. But that has emerged quite recently. And then in places like South Africa, we have the other challenge is that we, for want of a better word, are competing against many other issues. So when you try to tackle an issue like drowning, you're competing for attention and resources with big issues like trauma and violence and road traffic and HIV. So it's quite tricky to motivate for resources into drowning prevention, in the face of these other big burdens.
It sounds just like we're talking about the United States and even the issues we face here in Hawaii, which is amazing to me. You state, and you could give a little background to South Africa, possibly in your conversation for those of us who are out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean or people who are listening other places. Kind of about the geography, the Indian Ocean, the Atlantic Ocean, but we can get into that. But I want to ask you this. You state that progress in drowning prevention has not been equitable with Africa lagging behind global trends. Why does equity actually look like, what does it look like in drowning prevention? Because we have that issue here, the equity of the indigenous population not getting access to things.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's a broad issue there in that statement. And then there's, I think, the challenges around, at a community level or even a country level. But, on a global scale, we've seen a deep, so the Global Status Report on Drowning Prevention that was published in 2025 now, no, 2024, sorry. That showed that global drowning rates are declining, right? There was a 38% decline in global drowning rates, but it was only a 3% decline in drowning rates, mortality rates in Africa or in the African region. And so the African region was lagging very far behind. And I think it's probably even more pronounced because we have quite a large limitation in the data and the surveillance data from the African region. So I think it's probably still even undercounted, and we don't have a good understanding of the burden. But then, so I think there's this like inequity in the efforts. Well, maybe not the efforts, but there's certainly a disparity in the decline that we see globally and within certain regions, particularly low middle income regions, or low middle income countries. And then on a country level, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head. We had a little chat before we started around the similarities perhaps between Hawaii and a place like South Africa. We're an upper middle income country, but we have one of the highest inequity indexes in the world. I think we kind of swap places with Brazil at the top of the list for inequity every couple of years. And so we have this challenge of like large areas that have that are well resourced, and then large portions of our population that are under-resourced. And it plays out in the access to things like learn to swim in the drowning prevention space. It plays out in access to learn to swim, in access to swimming pools, just kind of a culture around swimming even sometimes. It plays out in access to water sports. I think you describe yourself as a water person, right? And there is a culture of being a water person that comes with access to pools, access to these water sports that builds a comfort around being in the water as well. And that is not something that is experienced by everybody in our population. And it's certainly experienced by a small part of the population, I think. So things like that, I think that, you know, kind of come from this issue of access, which is definitely not equitable across our community.
So let's just talk about data because
Sure.
we have talked here about drowning. Justin Semsrott, who will come back on our show because he talked a lot about CPR and what parents should know, that they should all know a CPR class, which is breaths and compressions if they're around water. He did a very good job of taking that down to a level that most people could understand. So he's going to come back on because he's doing some training in California for first responders. But we talked about data and we talked about the fact that drowning is not a very sexy topic, and that, you know, we're now understanding, and I'm sure you knew because you're a researcher epidemiologist, and the data and the definition's been out there, but drowning and non-fatal drowning are two different things, but they're still drowning, right? So if we had a report here in Hawaii on Halane Bay, how many drownings we had in a year, maybe it's 1,000 because of non-fatal drownings, right? And we're not keeping track of the data particularly well. We're starting to look at that, but what do you know that the true burden of drowning is likely far higher than reported. How dangerous, in your opinion, is to build policy on incomplete data? And what is the minimum data system every country should have to start making real progress? Because we don't have that here. We don't have we're trying to get to that point where we have an actual data set so we can make good policy decisions. But it's the ability to collect that data, not just on fatal drownings, but on non-fatal drownings.
Sure. I mean, I think there's a few questions in there. And I have to say, I get really excited when we start talking about data because it's certainly going into my world. But it's, you know, I think you asked a question, and this might not answer it specifically, but you asked a question, what's the kind of minimum data I think that's needed for policy, right? Or what's the
Yes.
danger of acting on incomplete data?
Right.
And it's so interesting. I'm, as you said, an epidemiologist, and I think we need all the data, right? So we need to know everything before we act. That's my, I'm a scientist, a researcher, my brain works slowly. I want all the information before I start something. And then I happened to have a conversation with a policymaker here in South Africa, which trying to move forward on some national policy. And he said to me, well, what does the data say? And I said, well, we don't really have enough, you know, but we know this and we know that and we know this. And it was little bits. And he's like, well, that's enough. We can do something. And so I think it's interesting. So I think that there's a couple of answers to that question. I think for an epidemiologist, there will never be enough data. We want to understand everything to the minutest detail. But at some point, you have to start acting, right? We can't always just say we need more research, we need more research. We have to start trying to do something. So I think the danger probably lies in not recognizing that you don't understand everything, but if you can recognize what you do know, which is perhaps a burden, and you maybe recognize that that is excluding a the non-fatal burden, or you. If you understand what you have, you can start to act on it, even if you don't have enough detail or information. And so, you know, the you say do you, well, I think you were speaking specifically probably around Hawaii, around the non-fatal drowning data issue. I mean, I think that's largely a global issue. There's so little data on non-fatal drowning because it is really tricky to try and capture. And I think certainly for me, in many places, in Africa and definitely in South Africa, we're still trying to get a handle on fatal drowning data and make sure that we have that big picture. But trying to track non-fatal, even though we have this really good understanding of what that is now, is still a big challenge. So I
We
think
have
the answer to your question is we can never have enough data, right? But at some point we've got to start.
Well, we see the same challenges. I mean, the World Health Organization came out with their information, of which you're mirroring in South Africa, that children are at risk, and they're the biggest risk here. 1 to 15, it's the highest risk for drowning. And the indigenous population here only represents 23% or so of the population in Hawaii, but represent 37% of the drowning. So, and we found that information out from a young man named Kalei Clark, who's from New Zealand and is now living here from Hawaii, and did research for the water safety plan and found that disparity, which is really, really great information. And so we're trying to move forward with programs that address that. So you emphasize that children bear the greatest burden. What are the most effective interventions? We are not scaling fast enough. And if a country could only do one thing tomorrow to reduce child drowning, what should it be?
Oh, sure. I think you've thrown me a hot potato here, but I mean, so, you know, as you rightly say, so children do have the highest mortality rates consistently, I think, with a few exceptions in certain settings. But, you know, and children under 5 in particular have very high mortality rates from drowning. I think this has a lot to do with. So, I have two young children. My eldest is 6 and my youngest is 4. So, I kind of have some recent lived experience in this. But children are just, I think their exposure is driven by opportunity, and I guess their exposure to the hazards around them. And they're naturally curious as soon as they get mobile. They want to explore their environment around them, and they're completely dependent on adults to keep that environment safe, and to help them navigate it safely as well. So I think that, and this kind of covers a group of interventions, really. But I think the biggest thing that we can do is make sure that we are putting them in a safe environment, and keeping them in a safe environment. And there's layers to that. So, things like being in early education centers, so daycares, things, keeping them safe, supervised, making sure that they can't get access to water bodies without us knowing. Keeping them safe is really the sounds obvious, but keeping them out of an unsafe environment is really the thing that we need to do. We can't change who they are, and we don't want to, because they have to explore their world and start to understand it. But we need to make sure that the boundaries are there, so that they can do so safely.
Yeah, we've had two things here. The Department of Health put out a message that said, eyes up, phones down.
Yes.
And the idea being at pools and always having a watcher, and at the beach having somebody watch and being present to watch kids while they're around bodies of water. Those are things that they've been trying to message here. The other
I
piece.
want to, if you don't mind, I want to jump in there. I think I 100% agree with that message. But I think one of the things that we forget about, and particularly in this young age group, is that, if we're doing our job as parents and caregivers, we are watching them, and it's the challenge often comes is when we don't expect them to be around water, right? So when they were in, for example, the living room, and we quickly stepped out to go and answer the phone or something, and then suddenly they get out and they get access to a pool or a bucket, or we take a phone call or answer the door quickly while they're in the bath. Maybe that's not unexpected access, but I think we have to broaden the look at supervision and safe environments to outside of when we expect them to be in the water. Often I think the safety, the creating a safe environment is putting layers in place so that when we aren't around, that environment is still safe. It doesn't depend entirely on our attention, and supervision at all times.
Layers in place. I've heard that said by a lot of people on drowning prevention, water experts. Can you tell me a little bit more what you mean by layers in place?
I think it's, we're all fallible. I am in the space. I've been a lifeguard for 20 years. I'm a water baby. My day job is researching drowning and drowning prevention. And I still struggle at home, with my kids. I still find that when I'm around the pool with them, there are lapses and I suddenly catch myself and we forget to put the pool cover on or things like that. I think so. We are all fallible. And these situations where you think a child is safe because they're in a particular place, and then they surprise you, or they move quicker than you think, or they get out somewhere where you didn't know that they could. Those things happen. And so I think that part of keeping children safe is making sure that there are multiple layers to protection. So what that means is, yes, supervision, it's critically important. And maybe we can talk a little bit about what supervision is as well. But I think supervision is really important. But making sure that when and if there are these lapses or errors, that there are other layers of safety in place. So particularly things like, if you have water bodies on or close to your home, making sure that they can't get access to those without you. So whether it's pool covers, pool fences, ponds and other water bodies are a challenge as well. This doesn't it looks different in different places. If you think of places like Bangladesh, where water is all around the home, it's quite difficult to put up a fence, but they're looking at creative ways of doing that. But the point is to have these layers of safety. And I also think exposure to kind of water, well, I don't want to call it swimming, but exposure to being in the water and starting to learn the principles of swimming and floating and things like that, that is another layer that maybe comes a little bit later than the age group we're talking about, but that is another layer, learning how to swim, learning how to float, making sure that there's restricted access to these water bodies, keeping supervision as much as possible, emptying. We had a drought here in Cape Town. It looks like we might be heading into another one, but we had some water restrictions a couple of years ago, quite serious water restrictions, and everybody was keeping buckets of water around their homes, and catching all their shower water and things and using it to flush the toilets. And so a lot of people had buckets of rainwater and shower water and all sorts of things all around the home. And anecdotally, we had a little surge in drowning incidents in and around the home because people forget about those as sources of risk as well. And so, the layers of protection is more than just supervision. It's making sure that when you forget about something, there are also other barriers in place. The shower door is closed, or they can't get access to those buckets of water. That's really what I mean by layers.
That's really very good. I would say also that you wrote this article, and I want to get back to what we're talking about, but why did you write this article and how did you get involved in drowning prevention? Can you give me
Which
a little?
article are we
Well,
talking about?
let's read about I have two sitting in front of me.
Sure.
I have Fatal Drowning in Western Cape, South
Yes.
Africa.
Okay.
I see that one, but I'm talking about the current one, or you could talk about both of them. But the one is Leave No One Behind, an African perspective on the First World Health Organization Global Status Report on Drowning Prevention. You could talk about
Sure.
either one, but they're very, very good. And I would just like to
Sure.
know more.
Yeah, so I think your question maybe was around how I got involved,
Yes.
and then where they came from, both of those. Well, I grew up in a small town on the east coast of South Africa called East London, and we lived in a little beach town. And I started doing, I don't know if you guys have nippers there. So it's like junior lifeguards when you're
Yes,
little, when
we
you're a
have
kid.
junior
Yeah.
lifeguards, but you have nippers.
We call them nippers, yes.
Yes.
So I did nippers when I was a kid, and then we moved to Cape Town, and I spent about 20 years as a voluntary lifeguard at Big Bay, here in Cape Town. And so I think life saving's in my blood. I've always had an interest in life saving, but I never really thought it was always my hobby. And when I finished my PhD, I was kind of struggling a little bit with where I wanted to go and how I wanted to establish my own work. I felt the work that I was in was a little bit saturated. And at that time, I ended up just doing some kind of analyses of media reports and things on the side, for Life Saving South Africa. And that ended up kind of pushing me into the space and realizing that actually there was so little research on drowning and drowning prevention in South Africa that I started dabbling in it on the side, and then at some point that became my part of my day job and my research focus. So I think it's always been in my blood, but now I get to do it during my day job as well.
That sounds very similar to a lot of people I've interviewed. They've been lifeguards, then they become doctors, then they become researchers, and they get into an area where
I think
nobody
there's a few
dealt.
stories around like that for sure. And then the Western Cape study, that was really interesting, and actually that I kind of got pulled into a working group trying to unpack. There was a particular season, a summer season in the Western Cape, which is a province of South Africa, a coastal province. But there was a spike in drowning incidents, and a couple of kind of organizations and the disaster management in particular got together and said we needed to just understand what's going on and try and come up with a strategy for preventing drowning in the province. And we tried to, so I got pulled into that from a life-saving perspective. I was with the life-saving organization. But as we were trying to unpack that, we realized we don't have the data. We actually don't really, no one's really interrogated the data. And that's where that study came from, that Western Cape study. So we took 7 years of fatal drowning data and tried to look at the patterns to help inform a strategy for drowning prevention for the province.
And what did you
So that
find? What did you find out
one,
from that study?
Sorry, we found, as you rightly pointed out, so children were at greatest risk. So I think about 40% of the drowning, the fate, this was just fatal drowning incidents, were children. And we definitely saw the highest rates in children under five. But we also saw these kind of high rates in young adult men, around like 20 to 35 years old or so. And what was interesting is that so the rates kind of spiked in that age group, but it was particularly in the men. So that particular age group had the highest ratios of male to female in terms of the fatalities. I think between 11 and 14 male deaths per female. So there were these kind of two really standout groups for us, these young children who drowned in and around the home, close to the home. And then this group of older, of young, like these young adult men who tended to drown, further, like larger bodies of water away from the home. So that dumped out. And then we saw some patterns around holidays and things as well, and seasonality. And all of those helped to inform the strategy that we developed.
So you have all this data, you've done this research. How is that moving forward with any kind of policy? And the second question, because I don't want to forget this, do you have, does South Africa have a water safety plan, which has been recommended by the WHO and then was recommended by the United States water safety plan, which they did, that every state should do one? Does South Africa have one?
So the Western Cape province has one. We did as part of that study, we did, so that's a sub-national kind of strategy for the province, but that one in itself is about 10 years old now. I'll go back to your
Wait
first
a minute.
question was around
You have
how
a
do
water,
we.
you have a, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but you have a
No,
water safety plan that's 10 years old? We're sitting over here thinking we're full
it's
because we have one.
fine. But so maybe let me answer that question first, and then I'll go back to your first one. But so we do, so we have this provincial kind of sub-national one. But what we found, as I said, it's about 10 years old. I think we launched it in 2017 or so. So just under 10 years. But one of the big challenges, and I suspect, I don't know if this holds for the US similarly, but we have these three tiers of government. So we have national government, then our provincial government, and then a little bit more of a local kind of municipal district level government. But there is a bit of a tension between the provincial government and the responsibilities there and the responsibilities of national government. And so often, so a lot of the things that we recommended in that provincial strategy became really hard to implement because what they actually needed was an action at national level. And I had a student last year, well, the last 2 years that did some work. She did some qualitative interviews trying to understand different like actors in the policy environment and their perceptions around drowning. And almost all of them came back to like, well, these things roll downhill. So like you have to have national policy and guidance to get the buy-in at a sub-national level. And then once that instruction is in place, then that kind of things can happen at a local level as well. So to answer your question in a long-winded way, we don't have a national strategy. We have a big red dot on our country page in the Global Status Report. I think there are a sufficient number of people that are now advocating hard for it. And one of the things that the Global Status Report did was, I think, because there's now a big red dot on our country page,
Right.
it has spurred some interest at a national government level to try and look at how we can develop a national strategy. So the conversation that I had with policymakers around data, and it was exactly around this, is we have started to have the conversations around developing a national strategy in a process, and we've had some buy-in from national government. but we're in the early stages. So we don't have one yet, but watch the space. Hopefully, within the next year or two, there will be one. And I think that's really needed to drive action at both provincial level and then at local level.
You're exactly right. And it sounds like a conversation we have here all the time here in Hawaii. We have legislation now to create a Department of Water Safety so that everything's coordinated under one umbrella, the messaging, the data collection, everything. And hopefully that will pass. We have something very specific. We have not talked about anything specific about your activities recreationally and how the geography of South Africa is with the Indian Ocean and the Atlantic Ocean. If we had a couple of minutes, we could talk about that. And then your Surf Life Africa and then National Sea Rescue Institute, which is very interesting to me also. But the issue here is that we know that we can do certain things. And the legislation around something for free diving, which is an activity that is very culturally aligned here in Hawaii. So there's some legislation about putting specific warnings on labeling to say these are considerations. You should be careful when you buy this, just reminders. If we get that kind of thing on particular free diving equipment, which is not made here, but made internationally, maybe in China, that could have maybe global implications according to that. We also have an issue, and we haven't talked about, is water safety in our schools has been a big issue. We used to have it all the time. And as you said, swimming isn't the first thing, it's water competency or survival. Being able to float, those things are important. We have talked about that a lot here. And we're trying to get that back into the schools, at least as part of the PE, understanding rip currents, understanding the ocean, right? And bodies of water and how to survive in them. And it's been difficult to get it back in the schools. Do you? I've kind of run around that conversation a lot. Do you have anything in your school system that talks about water safety?
Oh, this is such a difficult, it's really a hot topic here, and it's one of the biggest challenges that we have, I think. So exactly, we have a lot of, so you spoke about Life Saving South Africa, you spoke about the National Sea Rescue Institute. There's a couple of other organizations. There's a wonderful local organization called the Darcy Sunshine Foundation here as well. But there are a lot of kind of these charity-based, community-based programs which try to bring water safety awareness and education into the formal education system. So the problem is that those are add-ins. And so what it is, it's a package or a program that these organizations have developed, and they are all wonderful, all of them. But then there's no formal incorporation of that into the curriculum. So in our curriculum, our basic education curriculum, we have a subject called life orientation, which is kind of all sorts of, it's exactly what it is, what it says, I suppose, is, all sorts of things that you need in life, right? Unfortunately, they haven't taught us how to do our taxes or anything, but there are some component or elements of water safety awareness in that curriculum. And so often these programs are brought in to address that particular part of the curriculum, but they kind of come in once a year or a couple, maybe even a couple of times a year. But what we're really trying to advocate for, and this is really difficult because every issue in South Africa wants a piece of the curriculum, right? Everybody wants some of they want, violence prevention, road safety. Everybody wants to be in the curriculum. And so it is, it's really challenging to get the water safety and awareness, the kind of theoretical understanding and knowledge into the curriculum. And then on top of that is, this issue of like access that we spoke about earlier as well. So my kids both do swimming, swimming lessons. So my daughter is in grade one, and she has once a week at her school. She has a swimming, a learn to swim lesson. And then they have after school swimming, et cetera, because they have a pool on the premises. But that's probably, I don't know, I'm gonna thumb suck here because I don't have the numbers, but maybe that's 20 to 30% of the population has that kind of access.
Yeah.
And there are many, many schools who don't even have the basic kind of facilities for their curriculum, let alone all the extramurals and things as well. So, I think there are so many opportunities within our education system to try and build exactly as you said, learn to swim and the water competency as well, into their that that they kind of leave the basic education system with those skills. But in order to do that, we have to try and develop systems that can address this issue of access. So whether it's it doesn't always have to be a pool at a school, but it needs to be a program that allows access to a pool close by. But and that is one of the things that this organization that I spoke about, the Darcy Sunshine Foundation, they've done really well. They've partnered with private swimming schools to get children from schools that don't have access and actually take them to these small private swimming schools, and they go there once or twice a week, I think, and they get swimming lessons.
What's the
So
name of the
they're really trying
foundation?
to,
Oh, I'm sorry.
it's called Darcy Sunshine Foundation. And I think it's the founder, Kirsty Doig, is actually a Scottish woman, but the organization is based here in South Africa and in Scotland, I think.
We'll talk about.
But yeah, so getting into the education system, universal challenges.
We're surrounded by water out here, so it seems to me people have said we're the epicenter of water safety. There's no reason why it shouldn't be here. But you're South Africa, and not everybody is on the coast. So
Yes,
you have
yes.
inlands and rivers and things like that. Give us a little brief geography lesson 101 of South Africa and the ocean, the Indian Ocean, the Atlantic Ocean, what are your challenges there?
Sure. I mean, so, and I think this really speaks to your point earlier about this issue of why drowning has been kind of under-recognized before as well. I will get to South Africa now, but because I think we also quite narrowly associate drowning with, kids in swimming pools, people at the beaches. When in reality, so we have a really long coastline. If I tell you the number that's in the top of my head, I'll be lying because I can't remember exactly, but we have a really long coastline. And there are vast stretches of it that are unprotected in terms of life-saving services. So we have a lot of like really remote coastline as well. We do have a really well-established voluntary life-saving service across the country. So that's along the coast as well as inland on particularly some of the big dams. In our inland provinces, we have quite a big area in our country. But there are, the life-saving services are certainly they're localized to the urban centers, so the big cities along the big and medium-sized cities along the coast, and there are kind of these vast stretches of coastline in between that have no life-saving services. And you touched a little on the kind of the two sides of the country, right? So I'm on the west coast. We have quite brutal cold winters, so our life-saving services stop kind of very soon. Easter weekend, we normally run up to. Whereas along the east coast, so Durban, East London, Port Elizabeth, they will run a bit longer, and Durban I think runs year round because it's really beautiful there all year round. So we have these vastly different contexts, even just within the life-saving community. But the context of drowning is it's so difficult to describe because South Africa is this, we have these kind of really hot pockets of high income kind of environments where drowning looks a certain way. And it looks like maybe beaches and swimming pools and things. And then we have vast expanses where drowning looks very different, and it's associated with like water infrastructure. So things like irrigation ditches and canals and flood waters. So the East Coast has experienced a lot of really devastating floods. And we know from other work that about 75% of fatalities and floods are drowning deaths, but they're often not counted as drowning deaths. And so we've seen these devastating floods, particularly on the eastern side of the country. And those are things that we don't always associate with drowning, right? But it's
Right.
really hard to address the issue of someone swimming between the flags on a beach in Cape Town and in the same breath be addressing the people that are kind of getting their homes washed away down a river in flood. And so we struggle with this like wide range of contexts of drowning, inland, coastal, urban, rural, high income, low income. The contexts are so different across the whole country that I think that's probably one of our challenges is everybody has a particular area of interest, and so they kind of advocate and try really hard to resource a particular area of drowning prevention. Whereas I think we need something national to really try and help us pull this all together and say, hang on, we're working in one space actually, and we need to try and tackle this systematically.
I don't think I could have said that better, or what has been said on this show is that's exactly the case. And what you're describing is really kind of a microcosm here, right? We just had major flooding. I don't know if you saw that in the news here in
Actually,
Hawaii.
yes, I did see that a few weeks ago.
Yeah, it's just Oahu, Maui, the Big Island, Kauai was, we were really lucky not to get anything. In 2018, we had horrible flooding here on the North Shore. But as you know, climate change and everything is helping to make these things be a lot worse than they've been. And the elevation of the sea levels, we're seeing a lot of issues around flooding that we were never seeing before. So you're right, and we're all trying to attack a different problem. We were lucky here because we have this water safety plan that people are actually looking at here in Hawaii. And the governor said, if you read it and take it to heart, you could save lives. So it's really kind of a working water safety plan. And in that, retention ponds, as you described, is a big issue here. And we were able to get a law passed to put barriers around retention ponds because one of the authors of this water safety plan lost a child to that. She could swim, but her friend couldn't, and she went in to save her, and there was no barrier on this water, on this retention pond. So you're right, there's different ways that people can drown. It's not just the ocean or a swimming pool.
Sure, yeah. And I think that's something that's often misunderstood. And I even find myself occasionally, particularly in conversations like this, where I'm talking with other people from the life-saving space, you fall back, even though I fully appreciate the broad nature of water hazards, I often fall back to what I know, and what I know is the beach, right? And the pool and the environments that I live and recreate in. And so I think it's, we have to consciously be bringing those other issues to people's attention and our own, and making sure that we aren't, lifeguards are an important kind of system element for safety, both at the coast and inland. And we can't forget about that, but they aren't going to address the issue of flood-related drowning. So we have to make sure that we're trying to unpack all elements of this issue.
Right. It's an evolving kind of world crisis. And the more people we have on here, the more we learn about what we're doing right and maybe where we could learn more. And hopefully we can help you in that regard. So, in your Surf Life Africa, is that pretty much the same kind of organization that's in the UK and in Australia and New Zealand?
So I think you're talking about life-saving South Africa.
Yes.
So that is our national life-saving kind of authority. It's our national organization. It's a public benefit organization, so a non-profit. But it's the standard holder for the life-saving kind of qualification in the country. So it's responsible for most of the training and certification, and as I say, the standards around life-saving services. So even though it's a voluntary organization, often it's our voluntary trained lifeguards that end up working in the paid for services around the country as well.
So you're saying on Durban, on the Indian Ocean side, would that be correct?
That's right, yeah.
So it's more mellow conditions is
Oh
and
no,
warmer.
definitely not.
Okay, so
No.
where is Jeffreys Bay? I'm getting
So
kind of
Jeffreys
off topic.
Bay is a little kind of southeast. So as you start coming down the east coast,
Okay.
around the bottom. But Durban, so Durban's big surf. It's quite a wide kind of open coastline. So big surf, big rips when the storms come. They have lots of rivers as well. So lots of river mouths that create quite interesting conditions there as well. Bit sharky, and but warm water. So it's really that's it's warm water and beautiful weather year round. So that's why the lifeguard services on that side will carry
Oh, okay.
on year round. And then the West Coast is a so it's the Atlantic. It's cold water. Very cold water. And the conditions, so the coastline's quite different. It's sort of made up of like a collection of, I want to say, bays almost. And so each of those have very much their own characteristics around the surf and swell and water temperature and things. But it can get pretty in winter when our big storms come through. The conditions can get really rough, for sure. A little bit different to the Durban side, but yeah, pretty rough.
So the lifeguards are not working after this month there, is that what you were saying? Or maybe.
Yeah, typically most of the Western Cape services will finish Easter weekend. So we have Easter weekend's always a pretty big weekend here. But then it's starting to. I mean, I say it's starting to get towards winter now, but we're in the middle of a bit of a heat wave at the moment. But yeah, we're starting to move down to colder temperatures and get towards winter.
So we have an issue with tourists. Okay. Like 70% of drownings happen with visitors, and it's snorkeling is their main issue. I don't know if you have snorkeling, if snorkeling is an issue there, or if there are other reasons, and if tourism is a big economic value to you in South Africa.
Yeah.
On the beaches, on the coast, as opposed to inland and in the park.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, tourism is a big kind of element of our economy here. So really, really important to us. We have big numbers of tourists from all over the world as well. And I think our currency helps, so sometimes it's a relatively affordable holiday to get to
Okay.
us as well.
Yeah.
So snorkeling. I mean, particularly the West Coast, which is the colder water. Snorkeling's not. I mean, people dive, but it's not. I wouldn't call it like a big industry here. It's a little bit cold. Up, kind of East Coast, Durban, and as you move up towards Mozambique. Diving is definitely a big industry there, and probably snorkeling to some extent. The water's warmer, there's a lot more to see there. I don't think that kind of snorkeling and diving related drowning is a huge issue. I'm not saying that we don't have any. So, I mean, there's definitely been a number of stories, but I don't think it's emerging as a particular risk group. But what I will say is that like visitors, it's really difficult. I think there's some really good work that's come out of Australia around visitors. So Stacey Wilcox Pidgeon and Will Kuhn have done some work around visitors, and there's even within, when we talk about tourists, even within that there are these groups, these different kinds of tourists and visitors, and the patterns that we see are different within those. So particularly what they call overseas tourists is a bit of an older group. Often they're maybe almost retired or retired. And so they come with a different set of risk factors, right? So they often drowning in that group is often associated with underlying medical conditions. But then you get a younger group of visitors and tourists that are maybe kind of doing working holidays. And they often, that can sometimes be associated with riskier behavior and maybe some bad choices and, like a holiday vibe, if that makes sense. So I think even within this broader group of tourists, there are kind of different patterns as you break it down into different groups. But as a whole, I think it's recognized as a visitors to an area. And here we, like in Cape Town and Durban, they are very popular local visitor spots as well, right? So a lot of the inland population comes down to either Cape Town or to Durban for the holidays, the big December holidays. So we have overseas tourists, but then we also have local tourists, if that makes sense. And so I think the challenge there is that often the holidays, you relax, you let your guard down a little, you probably do things that you wouldn't ordinarily, you kind of do riskier things that you wouldn't do ordinarily. There's often a bit of alcohol involved. Unfortunately, South Africa has quite a heavy kind of alcohol culture around holidays and recreation. And often as well, you are interacting with activities like snorkeling. We also have like the stand-up paddleboarding, surfing, et cetera, that you are maybe not familiar with. So maybe you haven't really, but you're just trying it because you're on holiday, and you don't have a good understanding of what the risks are and what the conditions are and what you should be taking and not taking, et cetera. So I think it's a combination of these unfamiliar activities, unfamiliar locations where you can't read the conditions well because you don't know them. Even if you're a water person, if you go to a different place, sometimes it takes you a while to figure out how to read the space, right?
That's
And
a really
so,
good thing. Read the space. So, Dr. Saunders, what messaging are you doing in South Africa around water safety? Because we're doing messaging, but as the mayor said, we got to change our messaging because it doesn't seem to be really.
So this is actually quite an interesting conversation because this is a conversation we have internally all the time between different stakeholders. It's like, well, you're saying this and we're saying that, but it's all these things are important, but how do we not dilute the message, right? So, I mean, we have, I think across the board, we have a lot of messaging around supervision of children. So that is a big one for us, trying to promote this idea of it's an adult's responsibility to keep the young kids safe, and what supervision is, because supervision, you can't be supervising if you're sitting with a phone or you've had a couple of drinks, alcoholic drinks. So you have to be close by, you have to be sober, you have to be paying attention. So big one around supervision. So certainly in our life-saving space, and I think this is slightly different to the US, but we have the flag system, so the red and yellow flags, the safe bathing areas. So we really try to push the message of swimming between the flags.
Yeah, we don't have that here. We don't have that system.
And which is difficult because, we don't have enough patrolled beaches really to accommodate everybody who wants to come to the beach. We have these large stretches of unpatrolled beach. Many people want to go to areas of the beach that are quiet and remote, because they want to sit and drink, or they don't want to be kind of harassed by lifeguards getting them to swim between the flags. So I think it's certainly a message that we think is really, really important, but it is difficult because we also appreciate that not everybody can get to a beach where there is a lifeguard service that's patrolled. And the other big message, I think, is around alcohol, particularly in our big summer season, around public holidays and even this Easter weekend coming up now. We have a big problem with alcohol on the beach and around water bodies and rivers and dams. So that certainly is part of our big messaging strategy as well.
What do you do on unguarded beaches when somebody gets in trouble, and what kind of system do you have that can alert lifeguards or fire departments? What's your system?
It's difficult. There are some stretches. So there's a couple of reasons why beaches might not be patrolled, right? And it's this difficult conversation because if it is a dangerous beach and it's not a very good swimming beach and there are rips, and then we don't want to put lifeguards there because then you're saying, well, come and swim here, right? It's fine. So there are certain stretches of beach that are unpatrolled because they are inherently unsafe for swimming. And then obviously there's all the signage and things, but people will choose to go to the beach where it's closest and easiest. So some of those beaches that are in the urban centers, the National Sea Rescue Institute here in South Africa, they have this really great initiative that it's a recent kind of advancement, but they have started putting up cameras that are actively monitored. So in their emergency center, and particularly along these stretches where they are unpatrolled, and so they are able to. Their beauty of the resolution on them is amazing, and they're able to kind of identify risky spots on a particular day because of rips and things, and then they will actually monitor them, and they are able to, when they see someone in trouble, activate nearby services. So whether it's a sea rescue service or a lifeguarding service that's close by. Or they might try and, get law enforcement or something down to move people along to a different beach. But that is at the moment very much restricted to a handful of beaches, particularly around Cape Town. And the reality is that for large stretches of the coastline, if something happens to someone in those spaces, if it's not witnessed, it's going to be a while before someone is alerted to it and something happens. If it's witnessed, we do have some emergency numbers that you can activate the local sea rescue stations, or we have in certain kind of urban centers, we have these coastal rescue groups, which is a collection of local lifeguards and sea rescue and maybe other rescue services and EMS and things that can be activated.
Right.
And they're quite localized. But yeah, it really is quite a problem. And a lot of actually, I would say almost all our coastal drowning happens in these spaces that outside of duty hours and duty patrolled areas.
So these cameras, they're not AI driven. They're
No,
just
there's a person sitting there, a couple of people, kind of monitoring them and watching them. And I've seen it. It's quite amazing. But I think there's quite a lot of work coming from different parts of the world around AI recognition. I've seen some. I don't know whether it's New Zealand or Australia that are doing some work around rock fishes and cameras at certain hotspots that can detect when someone falls in the water and sort of sends an alert. I do think that is probably one of the areas with good potential for drowning prevention utility.
yes, I see that is probably ex just what you said. So in areas where there's nobody able to guard it, it's a risky area. It's got bad conditions. I think that makes a lot of sense. So I think the development of AI in that direction, I hope will have some promise. Dr. Saunders, so you've written these articles, and this one was in the African Journal of Emergency Medicine.
Yes.
Are people reading that and taking to heart, like our Governor Green said?
I mean, that's a million-dollar question, right? And actually, I think this is an unanswered question from earlier that you raised, and then we got sidetracked a little.
Yeah.
But is like, how do we get evidence to action? I, you know, and I, it's difficult. So I think I think there are various ways of communicating. So I don't think that the policymakers in my environment are reading that article. I think maybe, what that article in particular speaks to maybe a particular interest group or people that are already interested in the space, maybe academics, maybe clinicians, rescue services, etc. But I think it highlights what we're trying to do there is highlight that particular issue to groups that aren't already necessarily interested, or not interested, but it's not on their radar, right? We're trying to get it on a broader like radar. But do I think my president or whoever, the minister of health, is reading that? Probably not. And so I think that those are useful and they're academic and they're thought leadership pieces, but the policy action comes from interactions. And this is it's really a difficult space when you're a scientist, epidemiologist, and you kind of want to play with data all day. It's really difficult to put yourself into these situations where you have to try and speak the policy language and try and reframe your issue into the issues that people are interested in and are willing to resource as well. So I do think we have to take the drowning message and advocate for it outside of our usual places and spheres of influence, which is not always comfortable.
Right.
And often it's a very different language to that which we are used to speaking as well. So whether you work in an academic community or a lifesaving community or a CUSU community, you use different terms, you speak differently, right? But when you start moving into policy environments, you have to speak a different language and you have to really be very clear on what your message is and what it is that what your ask is as
Oh,
well.
that's true. Then, if you're on this particular show, were you just talking to me, an average person, and people listening, trying to understand the issue around drowning, to hear it from different perspectives and hear it over and over again till you go, yes, we have a problem. And people will say here to me all the time, we have a problem, right? We take drowning as inevitable, not as preventable. And you mentioned that in the very beginning. Talking about it's a series of actions that happen that we can prevent, but we're not doing that. And I go back to what Mike Tipton said in his interview with me, which was, the value of statistical life, right? The years of life lost. And I wasn't really paying attention to that. And then when you start looking at that and everybody in policymaking is going to get to a point where they go, how much is this going to cost? Right? But even in the World Health Organization, they're talking about for every $9 US dollars invested, I mean, you get, I mean, for every $1
It's yeah,
invested,
nine
you
for one, yeah.
get, yeah, exactly. And yet I see these studies, an Australian study that used the value of statistical life. 200,000 and 3,000 estimated the annual cost of fatal drowning at 1.24 billion Australian dollars. I don't understand this. In the US, inpatient costs for the fatal drowning can average $96,000. In India, out-of-pocket expenses, 340 per incident. The major Australian study explicitly included search ambulance and costs of the burden of now what am I trying to, what am I trying to say? Of well
I think
anyway.
what you're trying to get to there maybe is the so it's always such a struggle with me. It's not my area of expertise around cost effectiveness
Right.
and but I think it's this it's the there are economic losses to an economy, right? When a person dies prematurely and those can be direct because of that particular kind of loss of the income that they will generate and the taxes and whatever that as the average person in that country. And because drowning is this an issue of young people, so either children or this young economically active group, particularly these kind of young men, the economic loss associated with a drowning death is much higher than maybe something like, diseases or things that happen later in life. But there are also, so there are those particular costs, but then there are also all these other costs that are sometimes included and sometimes not included, right? And this is one of the challenges with non-fatal drowning as well, is that we often aren't, we haven't really been able to quantify well the economic cost to an individual, but also to an economy, a country, around the care and the loss of productivity and the loss of productivity of the family around a person that has suffered a non-fatal drowning with, particular consequences. So there are particular medical consequences that come along with a non-fatal drowning, and these can be severe or they can be not that severe. But severe injury can really mean it can mean divorce in a family. It can mean loss of productivity for the family as well as the individual. So that there are costs to the actual care, and that can look different whether it's a private healthcare system or a state healthcare system. There are costs to the rehab, to providing with like specialized education, etc. And so often those are the things I think that we aren't including when we consider the cost benefit ratio of drowning prevention initiatives, because they are really, really difficult to quantify. And this issue of the value of a statistical life, it's such a horrible concept, but unfortunately it is a stats concept, an economist concept, that because it gives us a grounding for which we can start to compare different interventions. And so even though it is essentially placing a value on a person's life, I don't think anybody's probably comfortable with that, because really, how can you do that? But what it does is, if we say that this is what we're willing to kind of put a stake in the ground and say this is the value of a statistical life, what we can then compare is different interventions and how cost effective they are. And how they can mitigate those losses.
That is so well said. Thank you for helping me out. But I think when we start making policy, and as you said, we need an overall systems approach to drowning prevention.
Absolutely.
And
Yeah.
that's where we're at. And that comes with understanding what it's going to cost, right? And that's
Well,
always
yeah, I
the
guess it
question.
always comes down to, right, how much is it going to cost, and then what am I going to get for that? I think
Yes.
it's not only the cost, it's the return on investment that's really important. And that's why I think that report from the WHO was so
Yes.
important, because it really shows that how much, a small investment in, particularly I think it was daycare and learn to swim, can
Yes.
make such a massive impact, from an economics perspective, even.
That's so well said. And I think everybody who's going in front of legislatures should be repeating those stats over and over again, right? So people understand that a little bit of investment is a huge return for the
Yeah.
whole community. And as you said, non-fatal drownings in this small community, people drown kind of regularly, but there's a lot of non-fatal things that, as you said, affect the community, affect the family. It's kind of a trauma situation that we kind of live through.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, we'll leave it at that, but if you had the attention of global leaders for 1 minute, what would you tell them about drowning?
Oh, wow. So this seems like a really obvious thing, I think, in when I'm speaking in this environment, but I think it's something that I have knocked my head against a few times, that maybe we take it for granted. But I think the biggest thing that I would say is that drowning is not inevitable, it is preventable. And so, with the right systems and layers of protection in place, drowning incidents are preventable. They are not an inevitable kind of part of life or living in a, a city, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that if I really had one point that I wanted to try and convince people with power, it's that drowning is preventable and that investments in prevention are really important and that they have a good return on investment.
That's well said. Do you have any more research planned as a data scientist? What is next on your radar?
We're actually busy at the moment, so it's a really exciting project because I get to put my toes in the sand occasionally around this. But I'm busy working with colleagues from the University of Plymouth in the UK and the South African Weather Services. It's a project that's funded by the Met Office in the UK around rip current forecasts. So we're kind of towards the end, second, going into our last year of the project to develop a rip current forecast for the South African coastline.
Oh my
So I'm really
goodness.
excited. We're hoping to launch the forecast in April soon. So that's what we're working on. And now we're at the tail end of trying to wrap up all the impact assessments and things.
Could you give me like a little insight into that and maybe come back, Dr. Saunders, and talk about what you're doing? Because that is a big
Sure. So
issue.
maybe I'd probably direct you to one of my colleagues because you're going to ask me all the questions about the physics, which I don't know how to answer. But yeah, essentially, it's we're using so kind of there's a marine forecasting unit at the South African Weather Services, which so they have access to all the whatever it is that wave heights and wind and all those different marine forecasts. And so we've worked with partners in the UK at the I think it's the Coastal Marine Applied Research Unit at the University of Plymouth. And they have developed a rip current forecast which takes into account so these factors, these kind of changing factors, but also the morphology and geography of individual beaches. And develop these algorithms that really predict a rip current hazard, so a hazard rating in sort of 3 day batches. So there is currently one for around six beaches in Cape Town, and then this project was looking to try and expand that through to Port Elizabeth and to Durban as well. And it's quite challenging because the coastline is so different. So I spoke earlier about the quite different morphology of the beaches along the two coastlines. But yeah, it really and so part of this current part of the project has been to use things like to try and automate this categorization of the beaches as well. So use things like satellite imaging, etc., to help make it a little bit, that we can actually do it for the whole coastline and not manually for each beach. But it's really exciting. It seems to be working well, and we're hoping to get it launched soon and see how it's welcomed by the community.
Oh, well, I want to hear more about that when it comes out because I think that's great.
And then there's a few other projects in the pipeline as well. So I've got a couple of students working on different things. We don't have very good. So you spoke about the Western Cape study, but we actually haven't got a really good, like robust, epidemiological analysis of drowning at a country level. So at a national level, so I'm busy working with the South African Medical Research Council on analyzing some of their injury data. So hopefully that should come out soon. Some data around essentially a replication of that Western Cape study, but at a national level. And then I've got a student as well working. One of the big challenges, I wouldn't say big, but it's substantial. We have a fair amount of drowning that's associated with baptisms and religious ceremonies here in South Africa. So I think like your culture, we have a very interesting relationship with water. So, the water is kind of built into who we are and our engagements. Water is often the place that we go to when we have something special to either celebrate or recognize. And so many of our communities, baptism is a very important element of their religion or their culture. And so we're trying to understand some of the decision making around where to go and what's important and what we could do to support water safety in those instances without intruding on the, you know, the moment. So we obviously, you know, it's difficult to tell people to take to go and do this in the middle of the bathing area in between the flags, right? So we really want to try and understand how we can support that, but do it in a very sensitive way that we still honor the actual ceremony. So that's really exciting. I'm really keen to get that off the ground and start to see what emerges there.
That should be a good piece of research based on cultural issues around water safety. That should be good for your country. And one last thing, is there any legislation pending at the national level?
Not at national level. So as I said, we're in the early stages of trying to get a project off to, you know, develop a national strategy.
Right.
We in the Western Cape, we spent a lot of time over the last 2 years hashing out, and I really mean hashing out, to be quite an arduous process, legislation around pool safety, so you know, residential pool safety. So essentially it's a piece of legislation that says you must have a cover or a fence, and that's been really tricky to get to the point where it was kind of acceptable by the parties involved, and is so it's there but now needs to be essentially enacted, and we're hitting some stumbling blocks there. So there's some legislation in the works, but it may be, as we spoke about earlier, a little bit contingent on national policy.
Well, it's been an interesting conversation, and I hope you can come back because what you've written about is very good and very insightful. And hopefully, it moves the needle in South Africa around water safety. You know, what stands out to me is that drowning prevention is not just about the water, it's about the access, education, and reaching people who are too often overlooked. And you've talked about
Absolutely.
that in South Africa and even in our small state of 1.4 million versus, I think, what, 60 million in South Africa. But here in Hawaii, we're part of that global conversation and we're trying to understand how we can do things better. Whether you're a resident or a visitor here, the message is the same. Your safety starts before you enter the water. And the message that Dr. Saunders says to all of us that is drowning is not inevitable, it's preventable. I think it's a great line, Dr. Saunders, and I really appreciate you coming on because I'm going to remember that. And I think that's something that people think about a lot. And I appreciate your time. I really do today. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I've had a wonderful conversation with you. It's really been very enjoyable. Thank you.